Okay, today is June 29th, 2015, and I will be interviewing Alvin Sykes. He was born at Mr. Sykes. What year were you born?
1956.
1956. My name is Ann Lacey, and I'm the Arts and Humanities Librarian, and we are here at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library Main Branch. We will be talking about Mr. Sykes' work as a civil and human rights activist. So, first off, I've read interviews with you, and I've read some stories about you, and I know that you have spent parts of your childhood in Kansas City, Missouri, and Topeka, and Omaha, but you live in Kansas City, Kansas now. And how long have you lived here?
Well, I was conceived in Kansas City, Kansas, and I was born in Topeka, Kansas, and then the first 12 years was in Kansas City, Missouri. A woman by the name of Bernetta Page had adopted me in her heart and was raising me over there. Then I went to Boys Town for about 3 years, and after I came back, I came to my natural family over on the Kansas City, Kansas side. And since then, I call myself a metropolitan citizen because probably every 10 years I rotate back and forth. So I'm on my back to Kansas City, Kansas
That's
swing now.
interesting. Yeah. Well, you have a remarkable history of work as a civil and human rights activist. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do?
Well, as a human, excuse me, as a human rights worker, I specialize in victim advocacy. So basically, as a victim advocate, I help to bring victims of crimes and injustice together with law enforcement people to try and help them to get some understanding or some sense or measure of justice and truth related to their injustice or a problem that they have. In support of that, I do a lot of research and work on legislation to kind of make the laws more victim friendly. That's pretty much in the short version of what I do.
Great. Well, I know that you've received a lot of national attention for your work, and can you tell me a little bit about? I know you've worked on the Steve Harvey case, and you were instrumental in getting the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act passed. Can you talk about that?
Well, basically, the short version of those two cases. Steve Harvey was a friend of mine, and he was a musician. And back in 1980, he was rising nationally, and he just came home for a break, and he ended up going to the Liberty Memorial like he would do when he's in town. He liked playing late at night, so he didn't want to disturb his mom or anything, so he'd go play in the park. And then he happened to go to the Liberty Memorial. Well, it was really Penn Valley Park, but it's in the shadow of the Liberty Memorial. And he had played, he was finished playing, and then his Raymond Bledsoe and Roy Lloyd and James Graham were three individuals who would come routinely to the park primarily to harass homosexuals, because at night, homosexuals would hang out at the park, and they would come and harass him. So he assumed that Steve Harvey was gay, even though he wasn't. And Steve had finished playing. He went to his car and put up his horn and everything, and then he came back to the restroom. And so Raymond Bledsoe came in the first restroom, which was the women's restroom, and attack a guy who was sitting there with a dowel rod, like what you have in the closet to hang up your clothes. And he let him run off, run off. Then he went and got a baseball bat and came to Steve Harvey, who was in the men's room, and he hit him with the baseball bat. And Steve got up and started running, and so he chased him. And then when Steve tripped, then he hit him with the baseball bat and killed him. For several months, there was no leads as to who did it, and finally they did run a, get a tip that Raymond Bledsoe had came to a party the night that Ronald Reagan was elected, and had come back with blood all over him later that night. And the and so there was a state murder trial. That trial ended in an acquittal by an all-white jury in August 12th of 1981. And so after that, I, having worked closely with the Justice Department and realizing that you couldn't do anything more on the state level, so that if anything could be done, it would be on the, federal level. So I told, I called the Civil Rights Division, and initially the intern said, well, there's nothing we can do because murder is not a federal offense except under certain circumstances, and since neither the victim or the perpetrator were government officials, there's really not much we can do. So I went and told another friend of mine who worked at the Justice Department here locally, Don Berger, and he says, bull the rest, you know, that something that can be done. And at the same time, there was an investigation going on out in Salt Lake, Utah, where joggers, interracial couples, had been killed by a racist out there in a park called Liberty Park, and they were investigating it, and neither one of them were government officials. So when he told me that, then I went to the Kansas City, Missouri Library, and along with Steve Harvey's widow, and just spent the whole day, since Don didn't know what statute was, and I didn't know what statute it was, but we knew it was there. So I just kept looking at the books, and all day, and one lead to another page, and another, just kept on until got close to the end of the day, and it was literally about 10 or 15 minutes before closing, and I found the statute. Wow. And it said, you know, whether or not under color of law, you can't deprive someone of the use of a public facility because of their race. And then, that then, you know, I called them back, and when I called them back, they said that the same woman answered, and then I started telling her about the statute and what it said, and that whether or not under color of law, and basically color of law doesn't mean anything about race. What it means is if you're abusing the authority granted to you by a government entity, in which, you know, whether you're a policeman, you know, or something like that. Well, since this statute said whether or not under color of law, that indicated to me it means you don't have to be a government official. So when I took it back to her, I said, well, this is too heavy for me. You got to talk to my supervisor. And her supervisor was a lawyer by the name of Richard Roberts, and I talked to him. And Richard then said, well, send me everything you got because it may be something that can be done because it happened in the public park. And so sent everything to him. A federal criminal civil rights investigation began. And 18 months later, another all-white jury convicted Bledsoe of violating Steve Harvey's right to the use of a public facility because of his race in federal court, and he received a life sentence. And at the time of his sentencing, he was only the fourth successful prosecution in the country under the Civil Rights Act of 68, that section of the Civil Rights Act of 68. And so we felt compelled with this level of a victory to spread it around the country. So we went from being the Steve Harvey Justice Campaign to the Justice Campaign of America. And Bledsoe is still serving his time in the federal penitentiary. He's still there, and now he's went from being the subject of the fourth successful prosecution under the Civil Rights Act of 68 to the number one serving inmate in the whole federal system. There's nobody that's serving a longer sentence right now for a criminal civil rights violation in Raymond Bledsoe. So she went through with the Justice Campaign of America for 19 years, and it ended with the Emmett Till case. Mm-hmm. So now do I?
And so that was 18. He was convicted 18 months after the original trial. Is that right?
No. Let's see. He was acquitted on. I guess it was about that, because it was, okay. He was acquitted on August 12th. 1981, then he was convicted April 15th, 1983.
Okay.
So it was, and then he was sentenced on May 6th, 1983, and that's when we changed to the Justice Campaign of America.
Okay. Well, so you were also became interested in a case where there was a much longer span of time from the trial to when the case was reopened. Tell me a little bit about Emmett Till and the Till Bill.
Well, I first started not focusing in on Emmett Till, but it was first coming to me about Emmett Till when Steve Harvey's widow, while we were pursuing Steve Harvey's case, she kept saying, "This is the second hate crime in our family." On her family's side of the tree, not Steve Harvey's, but on her side of the family tree, were relatives of Emmett Till. And so time went on, and I never really got back to it or you know, thought anything more about it. And then in December of 2002, I was reading the Kansas City Call newspaper, and in it they were talking about Emmett Till. And how that there had been filmmakers who had done investigations and done documentaries on it, and felt that there were other people that may have been involved, and that they would, and that Emmett's mother had been, been trying to get the case reopened since 1956. So at the time, I was living with Marianne Flunder, who's on the Kansas City, Kansas. A community college board, and so I was at her house, and so I started searching to find Emmett's mother. And the next day, I was able to get her on the phone, as well as a cousin of Emmett. The name was Wheeler Parker, and so talking to Miss Mobley was just a tremendous experience. When I was talking to her, she was very business-fied. She didn't just say right away, "Well, I'm Emmett Till's mother." She wanted to know who I was, what would I do if you met the mother, what would you say, what would you do, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And I started noticing as the time was passing, and it's almost dramatic because, you know, Marianne had this big old screen TV, and it was just like everything started going blank, and it was just, I felt like I was in a whole nother world, and I was just me and this person on the phone. And it was about 10 or 20 seconds before she first said the words, "my son," that I realized that I was talking to her. And so after talking with her, me and Don Berger drove up to Chicago, and talking with Wheeler Parker, and drove up to Chicago. And I had already contacted the Attorney General's office, so I already had a sense that we were going to get this rolling in terms of investigating. And so then I we met with her at her house, and she was really just joyful. She was in the kitchen making a cake for us, and all like this. And then she sat down and did like she had been doing for the last 50 some years, and I was telling the story of what happened to her son. And following that, we decided that jointly that to form a Emmett Till Justice Campaign, similar to what we did with Steve Harvey Justice Campaign, would be the appropriate route to go. And so a couple days after that, her, me, Don Berger and this, one of the filmmakers, Keith Beauchamp, formed the Emmett Till Justice Campaign. And its twin goals was to pursue Emmett Till's case and see if there was any way that it could be reopened and investigated, and if possible, to be prosecute, as well as to exonerate anybody who may have been falsely accused of being involved with the case over the years. And then the second goal was to pursue other cases and potential legislation that would be helpful to that process. Unfortunately, 6 days later, she died. So she lived long enough to pass the torch on to us. We carried it on, went to Washington, going back, you know, several different times. The irony of it was that without getting into the boring part, the federal government can't just go into any case, which is similar like what was the Steve Harvey case. So there has to be some federal statute, no matter how bad the injustice is, there has to be some federal statute that's potentially being violated in order for them to have jurisdiction to investigate it. And that was one of our hurdles in this case. And so I reached out to Richard Roberts, who had become a mentor of mine on various cases since then, and since Steve Harvey's case. And he said, tell him to go the route of the Kennedy investigation. And what that basically was that the reason they were having problems jurisdiction-wise was because on the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, there was no federal law that made killing the President of the United States a federal offense. And so in order to, you know, there was a federal statute that said if two or more people are involved in keeping a federal employee from performing his job, then that was jurisdictional, but not killing the President of the United States by a single person. And so what they wanted to, so they didn't have the ability to get into the case, but just as the government does, when the government wants to do something, they can find a way to do it. So Antonin Scalia, who's now in the Supreme Court, he, at the time, was Assistant Attorney General for Legal Affairs, and that's where the Attorney General goes to get his legal opinions that he needs on what they can do, what they can't do, and blah, blah, blah. And so Antonin Scalia investigated, and he interpreted this federal statute that said that the feds can investigate a matter to detect whether a crime had been committed. And if they determine that a crime had been committed, then they can go further to determine whether it's federal jurisdiction or state jurisdiction on it. And then if they investigate and find out that it's not federal jurisdiction, but it may be state, then they forward their reports to the state and work with the state on it. And so, armed with that, that's what allowed the federal government back then to do a limited reopening of the Kennedy assassination and to determine if there was more than one person involved. Fast forward, when after King was assassinated, ironically, the bill that he was advocating for passage at the time of his death, as well as the same bill that the president signed a week after his death, would have given jurisdiction to the feds in King's assassination. But since it wasn't a law that day, they didn't have the jurisdiction. So that when the King family went to the president, Clinton had Attorney General Janet Reno to meet with him and to dig up and look at that same report that Scalia did that allowed him to go into the Kennedy assassination. And so that allowed them to look at the King investigation. So when I got the copy of Scalia's report and I seen everything, I said, oh, well, this fits. And so I said, well, if it's good enough for Kennedy and it's good enough for King, it's good enough for Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got it to that level, to have both the case investigated, reopened and investigated, and then subsequently the use that apparatus for the basis of the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act. And well, I guess I could probably just put them both together because you're going to slice this up, right?
No, we're probably just going to just keep talking.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that was what we used to investigate the individual case of Emmett Till. But then while that case was going on, the investigation was going on, Senator Schumer from New York and Senator Talent from Missouri, they both introduced this non-binding resolution in Congress saying, well, we need to, you need to speed up your investigation into Emmett Till's case because witnesses are dying and blah, 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 blah. And so I was upset when I seen that they had introduced this resolution. And so I contacted Talent's office and subsequently talked with him. And I said, as well intentioned as this may be, at best it's symbolic because it's not going to make the feds go any quicker than what they're already doing. They're driven by facts. So it's whatever it takes to get the facts and evidence, they follow the trail. And so, but at worst, it could interfere with the investigation because if the feds go through and do an investigation and they charge someone, the first thing any a defense attorney worth his salt would say is, well, this happened because it was a rush to judgment, because Congress told the Justice Department to hurry up in a criminal investigation, and if they had took their time and did it right, they'd have found out my client wasn't involved in this. Mm-hmm. And so I told them, at worst, you could be interfering with a criminal civil rights and criminal investigation. But I said, if you want to do something to get beyond symbolism, there's all these other unsolved cases that don't have the name notoriety of Emmett Till or Cheney, Goodman, Shurner, or any of the well-known names of the civil rights era. It was a lot of folks just Johnny disappearing in the middle of the night and nobody ever see him again. And I said, and so I can't form a blank justice campaign for all of them, but if you have a, if you want to do something that gets beyond symbolism, you create a unit in the Justice Department and the FBI that can systemically review and investigate these cases. And he agreed, and that was the beginning of the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act, which was passed and signed by President Bush in 2008. And it created these two units within the Justice Department and the FBI to investigate unsolved racially motivated murders from 1969 backwards, and now it had a 10-year sunset on it, and now we are preparing to introduce Till Bill 2 in the next 60 days or so. We'll have it filed, and that'll be the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights and Federal Crimes Act, because it will be expanded to not just cover racially motivated cases and not just cases from 69 backwards, or just for 10 years, it would create a permanent unit, cold case unit, similar like if you see the cold case show, you would be similar like that. And there are a lot of cold case units on the local level, police departments, and then and it would be on that level is what we're pursuing with Till Bill 2 and continue and expand Emmett Till's legacy, because he was not just a victim of a racial murder. It was a human rights violation that would apply to anybody. Mm-hmm. And this one would not have any racial connotations or requirements or anything, and would not be, limited to any period of time, because cold cases really mean cases where there's no more leads. Right. And it doesn't have anything to do with the length of time or anything like that. So that's where we're at on both ends.
Wow, I hope we see that passed.
Yeah.
That's really remarkable. Can you tell me about some of the smaller projects you work on? Is there anything, any smaller case you're particularly proud of? Or?
Well, I'm really proud about most of all of them. We probably don't have much time, so I guess I can try and think of some that had, one that had more significance really to me personally. It didn't have as much significance to people in the community or around the country, but it was, I call it my character case. And that was a case of where I had and it was right before Steve Harvey's case, at least while the investigation, the state trial was going on and all like that. And I had a friend of mine, and he was also a musician, and he was kind of living with me, and I was living with my girlfriend and her family, and he wasn't living with me, but he'd come and spend the night to drive me to Missouri each day so I could go to work. And I was driving for the city over in Missouri. And so the short version of it is, he abused the friendship and engaged in a relationship with her and started an affair. And once I found out about it, then I split with her. There were other things contributing to it, but that was just the final. And then time went by. He moved in with her, and they continued their relationship. And then toward the end, because I'm a Buddhist, and so there was a forgiving side to me, and he had started chanting, and she was a Buddhist too. So just as I was trying to get turned the corner in terms of the relationship, he ended up being killed. And so when he was killed, and he had been playing at this club, and he got set up to get robbed after the performance, then I had to decide on what I was going to do. And, you know, one side of me was, you know, I ain't got to deal with this, you know. Yeah, he was messing around with my woman, you know, that's his karma, that's, I ain't got to do nothing. The other side of me was saying, well, but he was a musician. And really, both Steve Harvey's case, his case, and the four other musicians that was killed in that same 2-year period of time, that was more of a driving factor for me to get involved in these cases than the civil rights implications. The deterrent factor for me was the next time somebody's thinking about killing somebody, I don't think saying federal statute 18-2245 would be a deterrent for them from swinging with the bat. But if he thinks for a second, no, I'm not going to do this because it might be a musician, and they don't ever give up on it. That to me was more the motivation. So that's what drove me in the end to go ahead and take his case. and got it. The guy was prosecuted, convicted, and went to prison. So, and it was just at the end of that case was when Bledsoe got acquitted. And so I moved back to Missouri and took on that case. So personally, that case had more significance to me because it was a lot harder to take on.
Sure.
Steve's case was real easy. There was no decision making to that. I'm going to take it on and you in trouble. But
right.
This one, it was, I made the right decision, but it was a very heart-wrenching decision, and so it was my character case.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be it. But a lot of the other things as a victim advocate, you know, they range from helping people on food stamps to get denied. I've been working the last 5 years a lot with the Kansas City, Kansas Public Housing.
Mm-hmm.
Working with those issues, and there's been a lot of problems with the resident associations and all, and I've been working to help improve that for the residents here. Whole gamut. It just doesn't all make the newspapers. Most of the ones that make the newspapers are the civil rights
Sure.
cases and racially motivated cases, but the victim advocacy part, working with rape victims and victims of other, I'll have this one. This is one that's not really out, and that should really be, and that's the creation of the victim advocacy office for the Kansas Police Department.
Uh-huh.
That came about because at the time I would have victims. If you became victimized and you suffered physical damage, there's a victim compensation fund that can help with the medical expenses and this type of thing. At the time, the only government victim advocates were in the Kansas City, Wyandotte County District Attorney's Office. So you really didn't get access to the victim advocacy assistance while the police investigation was going on. Well, this one girl got off a bus, and this boy hit her and knocked out her teeth. And she was at the dentist, and the dentist called me because he knew me, and he called me and said, "Hey, I've got this girl here. Her teeth have been knocked out. We got to decide on whether to get implants or to get her a set of teeth, a false teeth." And so he said, but the problem is the money. And he said, we've got a state victim compensation fund. He said, yeah, but, you know, there's nobody to help on that. And that's why I was calling you. But if you tell me you'll work with her on it, I'll go ahead and get her, you know, the teeth instead of the implants so she can smile again. So I told him, go ahead and do it. I stand behind it. I'll contact the state get an application in for it. So he does. Well, in while he's doing that, I go to the chief of police, Swofford, at the time. And Swofford, I told him, I said, you know what? We need a victim advocate on the police level. I said, because a lot of times, victims need help immediately, that they can't just wait until the investigation's over and it goes to the prosecutor before they get some assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they need to establish one here, and as soon as the events and things happen, there's a victim advocate assigned to it. They can explain them their rights and assist them while the investigation's going forward. And so he agreed, and then he had his officers checking out to see if this is something that would be viable if there's enough people that would benefit from this, and they did their due diligence and said, yeah, this would be useful to have us in an office like this. So then they established a victim service office in the police department, and at the time it was first in the state at the police department level. And ultimately, I think either Wichita or Topeka came on after they seen ours up here and did it. And so that to me was a clear example of turning poison into medicine that had a long lasting effect. And it was also the reason why people, when I started moving toward in 2002 toward, or 2003 toward establishing units in the Civil Rights Division in the FBI, there was a lot of belief here it was going to happen because they'd seen what I did here to, at the police department with the victim service office established there. So that's, I guess, that those are examples that I can give.
That's a pretty great victory, too.
Yeah.
It really helped people.
Yeah, it still is, you know.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
I go and I see, you know, sometimes, you know, and what they, you know, the history now that they have and what the victim service officers does and how it's so much a part of the structure now. You know, only a few of us are still around to know back in the day when you didn't have that luxury, you know.
Wow. Well, you have talked about libraries and your appreciation for libraries, and that you didn't finish high school, but you've received your education in libraries. Tell me how that's happened and how libraries have helped you.
Well, at the time, my cousin played with the just local band called Threatening Weather, and they were so when I moved to Kansas, I ultimately moved with his family, and then I became manager of the band. It was called Threatening Weather. And at the time, my aunt, she was very strict, bless her heart. She was right, but she was very strict. And she said, you're either going to go to school or you're going to get a job. Nobody lives here if you ain't got a job or you ain't in school. So I started coming to the library. The driving factor, though, for me was not to avoid her. What it was, or even to fake like I was in school and back coming here, the motivation for me was because of what Bernetta Page had instilled into me and my mom about the power of reading and the love of reading. Education was very important to me, and I just, at the time, did not feel that what I was observing in the public schools, as opposed to Catholic schools, when I was raised up in Catholic school and then raised in Boys Town for 3 years, that there seemed to be more of a focus on getting a piece of paper than to getting an education. And so I was like, nah, that's not good enough for me. I ain't going to have but one shot at getting an education. So if I if that was going to be the case, that I felt that I could do as well or better myself than to stay within the public school system. So I transferred from the public schools to the public library, and I just started coming to the library every day and, you know, consistently, and go to lunch and come back, and made the librarians like my de facto teachers and
right.
And stuff. And at first I didn't really have a focus. It was just, you know, music and entertainment was, I guess, the initial catalyst of what I would start to read. But it started to evolve and get more into law and various parts of law. And so I started expanding and going to the library and to courts. So then I started spending part of the day at the library, the other part of the day going up to court, just sitting in on cases and watching them. Didn't have no connection to them, nothing, just go sit in the courtroom and watch them. And so back and forth, I would do that to, pretty much every day in terms here at the in Kansas City, Kansas main library. And then as time went on and people started hearing about the work I was doing, and I started getting involved in cases and different things and started moving forward. Well, while that was going on, the library became my mainstay. I mean, you know, even as time went on, if I needed to meet people, well, come and meet me at the library. If I needed to meet me up here or doing, and this was way before you had computers and internet and all like that. And so I started having more of a confidence in the educational prospects that I could receive by being at the library, in that it was going to be more than just a casual support basis. It became a primary source of education for me. And so time continued to go forward, and as I started getting involved in other cases and everything, the library became what I call the great equalizer, you know, because I was so fascinated by the knowledge that I could receive, the atmosphere at the library, and all. So, you know, the other side could have 10 or 15 lawyers and could, you know, have big offices and support staff, but as long as I had the library, I felt I was equal, you know. And that kind of drove me over the years, as long as I could get to the library. And I even started dividing it up, you know, like between Kansas libraries and then Missouri libraries. And, you know, if it was a matter over Missouri, I'd go over to the Missouri library. If it was a really difficult type of case, I'd go to the UMKC Law Library. But my main focused base, like if it was in law, it would be like my general practice was here at the at Kansas City, Kansas Library. And so that's why it was natural when I went to look up at the library for the statute with Steve Harvey's case and most of the cases over the years where I've been involved in. I either did them here at the library, or the library was one of the avenues that I went through on it, or needed to meet with folks and stuff like that, and became like my satellite office and stuff and everything. And so that's when I looked at the real value of the libraries that a lot of people were not appreciating or understanding of what you can do. And but I must say, if it was not for Bernetta Page, none of that would have happened, because she instilled with me the love of reading. If I hadn't had a love of reading, then this would be a big labor coming and doing this on it. Then I met Crosby over in Missouri. I told you before, I'm a metropolitan citizen, so about every 10 years or so, I'd move back to Missouri or move back over here. And it was on one of my swings back to Missouri was when I was looking at the Emmett Till case. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that fascinated me as I was going to the Missouri Library, was I'd be seeing Crosby Kemper going around talking to the patrons and, you know, seeing how they were doing, you know, almost like a waitress would do, you know, at a restaurant. And so I'd never seen that really. Mm-hmm. I started kind of, who is he focusing in on him? Then, as I was working on Emmett Till's case, in the law, in the Till bill, the national media started picking up on my work in the libraries and how I didn't have a high school diploma or GED or anything. I got it all at the library. So they would want to take pictures mm-hmm. of me at the library. So, you know, to do that, they'd have to get permission. So one day it'd be USA Today calling the library saying, hey, you got a patron there, and he's been doing all this at the library, and we want to take a picture with him there. And then another time, the New York Times calling saying, we want to do this. So finally, Henry Fortunato, who was like over the public affairs and stuff over there, he started going across me and saying, hey, you know, we got this guy here that's bringing a lot of attention and stuff to the library, and this is a story. And so that led to me getting a bond with Crosby. And part of what I was so attracted to was that Crosby was, he comes from a family that owns, I won't say owns everything, but they own a whole lot. And he don't have to, be a library director if he didn't want to. But he had 23,000 books in his personal library. Mm-hmm. And so I knew then that he was not, this was not doing this for a job transfer or to do this or, you know, to pick it up. But in Missouri, you had to be a library director at a public library, you have to have a librarian degree. He didn't have that. He had everything else and all that, but he didn't have that. So they went to the Missouri legislature and changed the state law so they could hire Crosby Kempton. And that's how he got the job. Wow. And so that part of the story just was so fascinating to me. I mean, not only do you genuinely have this in your personal life in terms of 23,000 books, but you would even go through the rigors of changing a law, like I know how rigorous that can be, mm-hmm. to change the law so you could get this job. And so that's where why that is really already here.
Yeah.
And
that was going to be
so. The thing that climaxed to what I call my graduation from the public libraries was after me and Crosby established this relationship, and I continued to work there in terms of the library. He has this program where people come and speak, and usually they've got a book out, you know, something, they bring an author in, and then he had other TV programs from the past. I can't think of the name of it right now, but it would take figures from the past, and they'd have actors be acting that person in
Meet the Past.
Huh?
Meet the Past.
Yes, Meet the Past. And Crosby would interview them like he's interviewing them today. And so I started going to all those and that type of thing. And then it led to one year them wanting to me to do my story. And so we kind of worked together on it, and I got C-SPAN, and they came in and filmed it and everything. And so and we did that in terms that year, and that was a fantastic experience. But a little bit after that, the seed was planted toward Crosby wanted to find a way to recognize me. So he initially started talking about having a right as a writer in residence. And, we talked about that, kicked that around for about a year, and then maybe 6 more months we didn't even talk about it at all. And then we kind of reunited and said, okay, let's do this deal. And so Henry Fortunato, when he got it to him, Henry started working on developing it. And so Henry wanted to make it a activist in residence. He said, because you ain't really wrote no book yet, you know, so say you're a writer in residence is a premature stretch, but you are an activist. And I said, yeah, but that's too confining for me. You know, what I do, anybody can do for any field of work that they're in. You can use the, you know, you don't have to just use the library for being an activist. You can use the library to learn how to be a mechanic. You can do the founding steps on being a doctor, or, you know, a whole lot of things. I said, so I wanted something that was broader. Mm-hmm. And so he took it to Crosby. And then Crosby then came, as I understand, Crosby's the one that said, then, well, nah, neither one of those. Scholar in residence. He said, because that kind of addresses not only did he use the library for his primary educational tool, but he was able to use what he learned in a great way, and that helped out so many ways. So that became what was January 30th of 2013. Was when I was named during the ceremony at the downtown library as their first scholar in residence. And that was a tremendous experience. That was like a graduation to me.
Yeah.
So I stayed and worked on that. And then I started swinging back to Kansas. And so when I swung back to Kansas, and then one of the commissioners that I was supporting was Terrence Maddox. And Terrence, person resigned from the Kansas City, Kansas, the Wyandotte County Library Board. And so he had to fill that seat. And so he filled it with me. And so that was the first time any public official had appointed me to a commission or a board. And then it made me to have the dubious distinction of being a scholar in residence for the Kansas City, Missouri library system and the member of the Wyandotte County Library Board at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's leading up to now.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, I know you've talked, many people see you as a hero, a local hero, national hero. And you've talked about your respect for Crosby Kemp. Are there any other? Do you have any other heroes?
Well, I guess my other, I've got various. I mean, heroes is a overused word, and that's unfortunate because there are people who really do fit that the bill on it. I would say another hero / best friend in my life would be Herbie Hancock, probably before your time, but Herbie was a great jazz musician, or is a great jazz musician, and one time he was coming to Union Station, I was 18 years old, and he came to Union Station. And he was playing, and I had like a play sister of mine who, she was into music too. She played while I was on the business side, and she was real pretty. So whenever she wanted to go out and she didn't want to be bothered by no guys or anything, she'd take me along to kind of be a block and stuff. And as long as she was paying for everything, I was cool. So to She told me about, took me to Union Station for just one jazz musician named Herbie Mann. And then she came back and said, you know, I want to go hear Herbie Hancock. And I at least heard of him. So we went to the concert at Ralph's Landmark. It was a club, like it wasn't a theater or something, but it was more of a club. And so before he started playing, and because we're musicians, we would it was natural for us to want to go backstage. So, before the concert. So we went, and the doors was locked, but I could hear this noise going on. And I was like, dang, what's that noise they back there making, you know? And it was chanting, you know, but I couldn't understand what it was and what they were saying, and, you know, and I thought about it, said, well, dang, this is a library. I mean, this is Union Station. Maybe it's an auction or something going on. But that didn't make any sense. So we went on and left and went inside for the concert. And while he was, all the time while he was playing, she was getting off on his music. I was getting off on, what was that noise he's back there making? You know? So then I got up, and after it was over, we walked up to him in line. And then when it got to him, my only question was, what was that noise he's back there making? And he said, Nam Myoho Renge Kyo. And he said, it's Buddhism, I'm a Buddhist. And I was like, wow, okay. And then he started talking about human revolution and how you can change your life and become absolutely happy during this lifetime and achieve your goals. And it all seemed like what I was already heading toward, that I was kind of in a rough type of way. And this just seemed to attract me in a diamond type of way. And so I spent the rest of the, he stayed the whole week. And I spent literally stayed the whole week with him and brought my band, to all 11 of them. They all come the next day, and everybody started chanting. But most of them, after he was gone, they stopped because he was gone. But me, I continued. It was like, this is for me. And so I started a 40-year relationship with Herbie, and he's been there throughout mostly all the ups and downs. You know, he didn't just introduce me to it and put a notch on his belt and leave. He maintained a relationship with me and communicating, and when I would have my ups and or my downs, I could always rely on calling him and getting encouragement. And he's seen a lot about me even before I seen it. So he became my best friend, and as well as my hero. And see, and now he's, you know, he still plays all over the world, but now he's an ambassador. You know, he's with UNESCO, the United Nations organization, and he was he's ambassador for intercultural dialogue. He goes around the world speaking about people talking together and coming together. So he kind of ended up being in the area that I'm in, and I came to him in the area that he was in. A lot of what I do and a lot of the focus, I kind of modeled after Herbie. The Herbie that I know, not the one that everybody else knows, but the one that I know. Personally, that's one of my heroes / best friend. When I look at everybody that's in my life that has had an impact on my life, it's my mother, my father for the natural contribution, Bernetta Page for her love and raised me, and then there's Herbie. And that would be the next one.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a real honor.
Well, I'm absolutely happy, and I want to do anything and everything that I can to pay back. I figure no matter whatever I get and no matter wherever I go, I could never pay back what I received in terms of from the library system specifically here, and then the discovery of libraries all over. I just got back from the conference, the annual forum of the Urban Library Council out in San Jose, and that was a very tremendous event, and speaking to the library directors, challenging them One of the things that I told them that think that I would hope to get spread around is I told them that when you go back to your libraries, you may see some folks who are sitting around and look like they're hungry, and they got their papers spread all over the place. Don't snub your nose up at them, because what they've been working on may be signed by the President of the United States one day. And they gave me a sustained standing ovation, and that was really tremendous in terms to me. So anything I can do to help, yes. That's what I want to do.
We're always happy to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.